The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. Well, this being the day that we celebrate Memorial Day, although it is the holiday is officially tomorrow, we have this opportunity to be together to celebrate it, which is lovely. And I'd like to offer some spiritual reflections that come up on this day, in particular with regard to the Buddha's teaching. So we celebrate this ceremony, this festival, every year, and essentially, it's a big offering of merit and compassion for all the beings, as Reverend Master Daishin said in his dedication, who've died and are dying as a result of wars. And this is all wars, anywhere in the world, at any time, for the soldiers, all aspects of the military, all other victims of war, humans and animals, all who've perished, trapped in warlike situations. So it's a great offering of merit, compassion, gratitude as well for the sacrifice of their lives, whatever their philosophy might have been or their affiliation might have been. And although we perhaps think of our own country when first, when we come to a Memorial Day ceremony and our own relatives and friends who have died, as Buddhists, we train ourselves to not place any conditions on our transferring of merit, the merit, i.e., the benefit of our practice, our offering of Dharma, our meditation. So this offering of Dharma, of loving kindness, we train ourselves to freely extend it to not only our own people, but also to any beings in need. Whatever country, as I said, or cause they represented, and for me, certainly, whatever side of the struggle they might have been on. So we begin with what is familiar, and we work out toward any that we might even have felt an aversion towards at one point. All of it gets included in the long run. We don't have to do that all in one chunk, but that's what we train ourselves to do. So to me, it's a very great thing to be able to celebrate this. The festival also offers us an opportunity to reflect on the universality of suffering, to contemplate the causes of war and violent strife, and may eventually bring us to ask the question of what we can do, certainly for me, to promote harmony among humans. How can we live in such a way as to resolve conflicts between peoples and eventually to prevent them? In my own experience, I'll tell you a little about that. Having been born and raised in Canada by German-Canadian parents, I was born in Canada, but my parents emigrated from Germany soon after the war as young people. And this brought up many questions in my mind growing up in this situation as a young person. I feel actually grateful for it now. But seeing, for example, American war movies on TV as a young person, reading history lessons in school at the time, which talked really just about events and battles and victories and losses, all of these things raised questions and didn't seem to answer the fundamental questions for me. One of those questions brought up a lot of sadness and confusion for me as a young person. For example, about, good people, in quotes. Who are the good people and who are the bad people? And why do we have good people and bad people? And as it happens, my people were the bad people at one time, and I was living in a country that was the good people. This is a child's view, of course, but nonetheless, these are real questions that we all perhaps have had in our own way as children, as young people. And I think they are good questions. Fortunately, as we continue, our questions deepen, and as an adult, I was able to work my way through those questions. But yes, these were the thoughts. Was there something inherent in a particular nationality or culture or a particular people that made them good or bad or special in some way? There were many European immigrants in the small towns that I grew up in Alberta and most of my youth in northern British Columbia, who had left Europe to find a new life after World War II. Most of the town was immigrants. But, of course, many of you would have lived in similar towns or have been around people who came over varying walks of life after the war. And, of course, that has continued every time we've been involved with the war. As it happens, I'm now an American citizen, so I have sort of a multinational background, which has helped with perhaps a push to resolve some of these questions. It seemed to me that everyone had the same concerns fundamentally and the same difficulties and hopes. And frankly, as a young person, they all seemed like good people to me. So something didn't make sense. Something was wrong with this picture. Of course, there were things that had happened that were bad, that were awful, but did they have to do fundamentally with people's culture, people's nationality? What was it that caused that suffering? And what was real virtue? I sensed the trauma that my parents had experienced during the war as a young person, and they were teenagers at the time. But we didn't really talk about the very real pain of it until I was older, when they began to be able to tell stories about it. So these questions and also the confusion born of them, as well as other matters, as are normal to any adolescent, fortunately, I should say, eventually brought me to begin to seek the root of suffering. And they brought me to some understanding of the universality of suffering. Friends of mine spoke of their father's suffering and trauma that they were still living with as a result of combat. I came to know that my father had entered the war at age 16. In his young mind, he was defending his country. Soon after he entered, he was captured, and he spent the last years of the war in British and American prisoner of war camps in Belgium and in southwestern Germany. And interestingly enough, that's where he learned English, or improved his English, and also it inspired his desire to eventually come to North America. And these and many other stories I heard pushed my young mind into beginning to go beyond the opposites. Perhaps you all have similar experience of some sort. Many years later, I can see what was happening. I can see the benefits of these confusions and these questions and this sort of being tossed between opposites. Somehow there was something wrong with this picture of creating enemies to me at the time. And I have to say, I still get quite emotional at these ceremonies, because they are an offering to people that I was related to, as well as to beings everywhere. And we still every day hear about war and struggles in various countries, and it's such a blessing to be able to do something to help. And this offering the Dharma, offering loving kindness, being the greatest of offerings. So all of this suffering that I was experiencing and hearing about was experienced by everyone in some way. And to me, it seemed to be pointing to a universal truth, but I didn't know it at the time. At that time, I hadn't heard of the Buddha's teaching. However, later, my questions, eventually, I realized, were leading me to discovering his first noble truth, that which he became one with on the night of his great enlightenment, that there is suffering. Suffering exists, and it's common to all beings, that it's a universal experience. It's a universal truth. And that may seem so obvious, you know, when you just hear that, but actually coming to it through your own experience is quite a different matter and has a very profound effect on one and actually brings tremendous peace. And I began to realize that this also had to do with suffering that I personally was experiencing and had been causing others, just in my daily life as well, even in small ways. So I sought help, and fortunately did encounter the Buddha's teaching, Reverend Master Jiu in this case as well, and took refuge in the Buddha, in his teaching, and in the Sangha. Like to quote something from Reverend Master Jiu herself, who was also a young person, a teenager during World War II, and was witness to, you know, the bombings of London, England, where she lived, and the terrors of that. So she, I'm going to quote from the Wild White Goose, her diary of her training in Japan, and this is part of the introduction. She says, "There will be many who will not consider my question to lack," and this is part of her reason for going to train and become a monk and train with her master in the Far East. "There will be many who will not consider my question to lack profundity, for I was asking why death and cruelty should exist, and I was an angry young woman who wanted answers. Time was to show me how wrong I was to do so. For what, in reality, was I asking? Actually, excuse me, a reason for being alive when so many of my friends had been killed? A reason for not being alive? Had I a desire for eternal life or a desire for total annihilation? All these questions and many more are facets of the question I took with me to the Far East, whilst the question I should have been asking was, when was the first arising of selfishness?" When I read that and heard this from Reverend Master Ji, I was so relieved because it was so much like my own experience, even though it was at the other end of the world and at a slightly different time. But again, realizing that the answer was in finding the root of suffering, the very root of it. And as she describes, and certainly is my own experience, and I'm sure you all know for yourselves, we work through these questions. You know, at first they have to do with external matters, and gradually they become more internal. And that's where real transformation begins to happen, and where real help comes from. But it takes time, and we mustn't despise those early questions. They're good questions to ask. They lead to a lot of good work that's being done in the world. But certainly for me, and I'm all of us here, in some way, we've been led to ask that question on a deeper level too. What is it that I'm doing that's causing suffering? What can I do about myself? And that is really where change begins, positive change begins. So I was relieved to hear this, that there was an internal solution. By doing something about myself, and for me it was beginning to learn to meditate when I was 21. I began to experience a peace of heart and mind. It wasn't wasn't accompanied by a lot of fanfare, but it was very definite that nothing else had brought me to completely. And I began to realize that I had been looking outside of myself for that peace, and it was only natural given the way the world works. But there is a way, another way, as the Buddha said and as our Vaisak invocation says. Yes, oh yes, there is a way. So this is where we all need to begin if we really wish to establish peace and true freedom in ourselves and in our world. And I agree with Reverend Master Jiu. I've come to see those as one thing. It doesn't mean that we can't belong to peace organizations and do good work in the world. Of course, we all should do what we can and with whatever legal means we have. But if that work is not grounded in meditation and stillness and in doing something about ourselves, in finding the root of suffering in ourselves, it won't come to full fruition. It's hard to believe that at times, but certainly it's been proven true for me many, many times over. And we only have to look at our own family relationships, our relationships with each other, to see how that works, and then extend that principle to nations and worlds. So acceptance of this first noble truth of the existence of suffering brings one to the question of the second noble truth of the Buddha, that there is a cause of the suffering. Naturally, that question arises out of the encountering of it. There's no way around the encountering of it. Often we're looking to fix it first and looking to find the reason for it before we actually sit still with the suffering and accept it. So that's the first step. But as we are doing that, as we come learn through meditation to sit still with it, to embrace our suffering, we begin to see that there actually is a cause of it. And there's something we can do about that, which is very liberating. Even a glimpse of that is very liberating. I believe yesterday Reverend Master Serena talked about meditation and training in the Buddhist precepts to our congregation and those here for the retreat this weekend. And these are this is the groundwork of our training, where everything returns to and comes from. So through sitting still with our impulses to act out of ignorance of our true nature, i.e., this being the cause of suffering, we come to see, acting out of greed, anger, and delusion, which in Buddhism comprise this fundamental ignorance, we have created harm to ourselves and others. And as we begin to see that where we have choices to not act on these harmful impulses, we begin to see that we actually can change, we can affect peace, we can actually no longer live in such a way that we're promoting it. Sitting still within the suffering and the conditions that give rise to it, we see another way to live and to respond to happy situations and to conflicts. Compassion, a more selfless love, helpful insights, natural wisdom, natural to our true nature, begin to arise in the mind when we do this. We begin to understand how we create harmful and conversely helpful karmic patterns. And begin to understand something about the law of karma. And it seems to me that there's something of a lack, and I don't mean to be critical of our educational system, but somehow something of a lack of understanding about the law of karma in our culture, and also about the law of anatta, no self. And this gets us into a lot of trouble over and over and over. We repeat the same mistakes. We don't seem to learn from history, although hopefully we are somewhat. Perhaps that's unkind, and perhaps over the centuries we are learning. We hear so much on the news about awful situations that it can be quite depressing. So it'd be nice if someone, we had a few more of the positive stories that are going around and all the many ways that people are helping each other as well on the news, but I suppose those aren't quite as appealing. You know, people wouldn't turn their TV on to hear about a simple act of kindness that helped, avert a harmful situation. But in Buddhism, we study those because that's the way. There are many, many examples, of course, of those to encourage us. I'm going to read you a little story from the Dhammapada. Some of you may know this story about how the Buddha settles a quarrel in his time, and consequently it gave rise to one of the verses of the Dhammapada. We live indeed so happily. This instruction was given by the teacher, the Buddha, while he was in residence among the Shakyas, with reference to, that's his people, to the cessation of a quarrel among his kinsmen. The story goes that the Shakyas, or Sakyas, they pronounce it here, and the Koliyas, these two peoples, in northern India caused the waters of the river Rohini to be confined by a single dam between the city of Kapilavastu and the city of Kaliya, and cultivated the fields on both sides of the river. The Shakyas were the Buddha's kinsfolk again. Now in the month Jetamula, the crops began to droop, whereupon the laborers employed by the residents of both cities assembled. Said the residents of the city of Kaliya, "If this water is diverted to both sides of the river, there will not be enough for both you and for us too. But our crops will ripen with only a single watering. Therefore, let us have the water." And the Shakyas replied, "After you have filled your storehouses, we shall not have the heart to take ruddy gold and emeralds and black pennies and baskets and sacks in our hands and go from house to house seeking favors at your hands." In other words, we'd have to beg you for our sustenance. "Our crops also will ripen with just a single watering. Therefore, let us have this water." Does this sound familiar? We might be heading into some times like this, you know. "We will not give it to you." And then the others say, "Neither will we give it to you." So talk waxed bitter, until finally one person arose and struck another a blow. You know how this gets going. The other returned the blow, and a general fight ensued, the combatants making matters worse by aspersions on the origins of the two royal families. You know, your mother, da-da-da-da-da, you know. And it gets ugly from that point on, you know. It sounds so familiar, doesn't it? Said the laborers employed by the Kaliyas, "You who live in the city of Kapilavastu, take your children and go where you belong. Are we likely to suffer harm from the elephants and horses and shields and weapons of those who, like dogs and jackals, have cohabited with their own sisters?" What not to say. The laborers employed by the Shakyas replied, "You lepers, take your children and go where you belong. Are we likely to suffer harm from the elephants and horses and shields and weapons of destitute outcasts who have lived in jujube trees like animals?" Well, both parties of laborers went and reported the quarrel to the ministers who had charge of the work. And the ministers reported the matter to the royal households. Thereupon the Shakyas came forth armed for the battle and cried out, "We will show what strength and power belong to those who have cohabited with their sisters." And likewise the Kaliyas came forth armed for battle and cried out, "We will show what strength and power belong to those who dwell in jujube trees." And I'm not sure what a jujube tree is, but it's a derogatory term, I suppose. As the Buddha, the teacher, surveyed the world at dawn, which he is said to have done every day, and beheld his kinsmen, because he lived nearby, he thought to himself, "Oh, if I refrain from going to them, these men will destroy each other. It is clearly my duty to go to them." Accordingly, he flew through the air quite alone to the spot where his kinsmen were gathered, and seated himself cross-legged in the air over the middle of the river Rohini. And of course, I don't think that one has to have supernormal powers to be able to help in such situations, but the Buddha in some way appeared. When the teacher's kinsmen saw the teacher, the Buddha, they threw away their weapons and did reverence to him. Said the teacher to his kinsmen, "What is all this quarrel about, great king?" And the king says, We do not know, reverend sir." And the Buddha says, "Well, who then would be likely to know?" "Oh, the commander-in-chief of the army would be likely to know." So the commander-in-chief of the army said, "Well, the viceroy would be likely to know." And thus the teacher put the question first to one and then to another, asking the slave laborers, and they had slaves in those days, last of all. And the slave laborers replied, "Why, the quarrel is about water, reverend sir." They'd obviously completely forgotten what they were fighting about. Does that sound familiar? Yeah. Then the teacher asked the king, "How much is water worth, great king?" And he says, "Very little, reverend sir." And then the Buddha says, well, how much are the Katiyas worth, great king? And Katiyas are the princely caste, you know, and the two princely castes were fighting each other. So in other words, the stock from which the royal family sprang. So he's saying, how much is, you know, the human blood worth, basically? And the king says, well, Katiyas are beyond price, reverend sir. So the Buddha says, it is not fitting that because of a little water you should destroy Katiyas, or human beings, who are beyond price. They were silent. Then the teacher addressed them and said, great kings, why do you act in this manner? Were I not here present today, you would set flowing a river of blood. You have done what should not be done. You live in strife. And then he begins to show them the way. I live free from strife. You live afflicted with the sickness of the evil passions. I live free from this dis-ease. You live eager in pursuit of the five kinds of sensual pleasure, but I live free from eager pursuit. We might translate that now into our consumerism or our desire for power, or whatever it is, or electricity, you know. So saying, the Buddha pronounced the following stanzas, and he goes on to give one of the verses that ended up in the Dhammapada about dwelling hate-free among those who hate and without the illness of delusion among those who suffer from it, and free of greed among those who dwell greedy. So in encouraging them to free themselves from their attachments to their greeds and angers and delusions. And it just seemed to me that this story very much is relevant today. You know, that was 2,500 years ago. And we don't have to have a Buddha up in the sky to be able to do that. It does point to some skillful ways that any of us can help examine a conflict and begin to resolve it. Now, the Buddha couldn't do this all the time. There were, in fact, times when his kinsmen did slaughter each other in the end, and he couldn't do anything about it. But he obviously prevented as much as he could. So he wasn't a god, but as a human being, he did everything. He did his utmost to train himself and thus be a help to them when it was possible. It was still necessary for them to be willing to listen to him. So he didn't take that away from them. There's still always that element of free will. We heard the story today in one of our invocations about the general Simha, a layman who came to the Buddha and asked him for teaching. He was a very famous general at the time, and he was a follower of another religious sect called the Nigantas, I think. And they said, don't go talk to the Buddha, no. And the general was very attracted to the Buddha, and they said, no, he doesn't teach the truth, you know, he's teaching about annihilation and so on. But the general just couldn't resist, so he did end up talking to the Buddha and asked him questions about his doctrine as to whether what they were saying was true. Interestingly, the Buddha answered him by saying, well, what they say is both true and also false. He often gave that kind of answer, which immediately cuts through the sort of, consternation or self-righteousness that could arise when we hear someone speaking offensively towards us. So he's very skillful in how he answered those things to begin with, or approached them. And eventually, as in the invocation, the general is asking, well, you know, what happened? You know, if there's evil, shouldn't we be protecting our children and our wives and our villages and so on? And shouldn't people who do evil be punished? And the Buddha said, certainly, yes, but we don't have to have hatred in our hearts. It's a matter of how we do it. The magistrate should not have any hatred in his heart whatsoever. So that points to, if we do have a profession where we have those kinds of responsibilities, to the importance of really training ourselves so that we can do those kinds of jobs with generosity of heart and spiritual insight. And eventually the general comes to ask him about, fighting in war, that he's a soldier, and so on. The Buddha doesn't tell him that he's doing anything wrong. He just says, there are consequences to it. So a soldier should not be surprised if he's killed in battle and shouldn't complain about it. You know, he's pretty blunt with him about it, actually, but no doubt he was ready to hear that teaching. One shouldn't be surprised if there are consequences to going and beating somebody else up, you know. There are going to be consequences. So he pointed to, as Reverend Master Jiu would say, an adult, you know, a spiritual adulthood, an accepting responsibility of our actions, and didn't give a simplistic answer. And then he went on to point him to the nobler way also, that there is a way, the Noble Eightfold Path, beyond fighting, that there is the conquering of self through training our greeds and our angers and delusion. And this general eventually, right on the spot, said, please take me as your disciple. He had to ask the Buddha three times. The Buddha was a little reluctant because he knew he was a disciple of another group. And but he did accept him. But then he said, on condition, he says, I know that you've been used to giving offerings of alms to the Nigantha, the other religious sect. And he said, you should not stop doing this in your home. Please be sure to continue to invite them to your home. So he's very wise and very kind, and didn't feel that, you know, because this general was so famous that he didn't want the news to come out, now this general is a disciple of the Buddha, and these people are all wrong. He didn't want this to turn into a difficult situation for him and the others. So he acted in a way that brought peace and yet helped the general. It's a very interesting story. So the Buddha here is pointing then to the third noble truth, that there is actually a cure of suffering. I know for myself, seeing that cause of suffering, even just a little bit, the fact that my mind was prone to going outside of myself for satisfaction, for comfort, for happiness, just seeing that tendency and going within was immensely helpful, and of course this is a life of training. In the third noble truth, the Buddha assures us that we actually can become free of suffering if we train ourselves. And in the fourth noble truth, he outlines the Eightfold Path, as you all know, or most of you, in which he shows us how to truly live in harmony with and at peace with our true nature, how to really detach from the ignorance of greed, anger, and delusion, and live more at one with universal compassion, love, wisdom, which is what greed, anger, and delusion are converted into as we train ourselves. And these are, you know, fundamentally, in my experience, this is what creates harmony. This is what promotes harmony. We have many examples in our present day. You know, Nelson Mandela did amazing things in South Africa, and there probably are many, many other examples that we haven't heard of. And perhaps you experienced them, you've heard of stories. I think it'd be lovely to collect stories like this and put them on the news, or put, you know, compile books of them. But there are some very simple things in terms of the question that I've been led to of what really does promote harmony among people. And I'm going to read you another story and end with that, about kindness. These simple practices of kindness and generosity are accessible to all of us. You know, we sometimes think the teaching is very complicated and we're not quite sure what to do. We have the precepts, but even that can seem a bit complicated sometimes. But I think the simple practices of kindness and generosity, and there's a fearlessness that arises from these virtues, if you like, that promote harmony and alleviate suffering. So when at a loss, always lean towards kindness and generosity, is my advice. Having been chief cook here for a time, and you know, it's begun to show me, and I'm really still working on this, just how helpful the practice of generosity is. And of course, one can't practice generosity if one doesn't have a lot of generosity given to one. So it's part of a bigger picture. But just how powerful, for lack of a better word, that is in terms of transforming our own training and helping others. Well, this is a story from a book called The Buddha in the Jungle. It's actually little stories and anecdotes of Buddhist masters from the late 1800s and early 1900s before certain modern modernities happened in Thailand. In Old Siam, they call it. And just to make a long story short, I guess it's interesting. They say here, before Thailand or Siam became a cash economy, the custom of sharing food and other resources with one's neighbors was widespread in every region. Pra Bodhirangsi lived, he was born in 1918, the abbot of Wat Phan Thong in Chiang Mai, reminds us of this fact, and so on. So just to introduce the topic, he said, people did not need to cook so many dishes in their own homes. Each household would cook only one pot of curry and distribute part of it to other houses. And other dishes came from neighbors. There were hardly any murders in the villages in which people shared food, which is an interesting statement, isn't it? And so they go on to talk about Buddhists in northern Siam or old Thailand were a diverse mix of several kinds of people. In their sermons, Buddhist preachers, teachers often used local stories to teach people how to practice generosity. And a British anthropologist in between 1910 and 1912 collected a lot of these stories. He was in the Shan states at the time, around the time when some very famous Thai masters were teaching. Anyway, here's one little story from Cochrane's translation. Again, going back to the time of the Buddha. Ages ago, in the land of Kokulu, there lived in a certain village a rich man named Sotika. He had many buffaloes and cattle in his pasture, and in his treasure house much silver and gold. The king, hearing that the Buddha had come to a neighboring place and wishing to see him, called all his able-bodied people to go with him, leaving in this village only the aged and the children, with servants to look after them. In another part of the country, there lived a very wicked robber chief who, on hearing that the king and the able-bodied had gone, called his band together to rob the village. Sotika, the old man, too old to go with the king, heard that the robbers were coming and commanded his servants to arm themselves with bows and spears and go forth to drive the marauding band away. His little daughter, Samoktasa, hearing the command given, thought of a better way. It's interesting that a lot of these stories have to do with young girls often coming up with really brilliant ideas. Proves Dogen, the great Master Dogen's point about even a girl of seven can become the mother of compassion. Coming to her father, she said, "Father, you have great riches in buffaloes, cattle, horses, mules, silver, gold, and precious gems. Besides this, there are with you many old men and women and children. You have much to lose. The robbers have nothing to lose and much to gain, and are as fierce as wasps. Your servants cannot drive them away. Let me therefore go and conquer them with kindness. If they are pleased, they may go away, for men and angels like to hear sweet words. No one drives a buffalo by scolding, you know, but gently leads him with a string and coaxes him on. So may I do with the robbers?" The aged Sotika saw the wisdom of her words and said, "It is well. Go, my child, with your maidens and meet the robbers. Offer them water to drink. They will be thirsty, and speak kind words to them." Maidens filled their water jars with water, fresh and cool, from the well, and carrying them on their heads, went forth from the village. They found the robbers resting in a shady grove of mango trees. Approaching the robber chief, Samoktasa said in words of polite greeting, "Whence have you come, and what do you, with all these good men, seek? Take a little water, please, for you must be thirsty." Thus gently did she speak to him. The chief, thinking in his heart that the little lady mistook them all for good men, did not want to tell her that they had come to rob her father and the whole village. So he, dissembling, said, "My little lady, the king and his people have gone to see the great Buddha. We too were going with them, but coming too late, we camped here. Tomorrow we will go on to hear the golden words of the great teacher." Samuktasa, undeceived, put her water jar on her head again and said, "It is very good to go and thus acquire merit. But let me help you, for you're all weary and hungry, that I too may share by hospitality the blessing that will come upon you." Receiving graciously the thanks of the robber chief, she returned to her father, who had already prepared for her coming. In a few moments, Samuktasa, with her companions, was on her way back to the robbers, taking with her four carts loaded with rice, fish, onions, pumpkins, salt, tea, and tobacco. With their own hands, they divided the food among the robbers, saying as they did so, "By using our gift, you will increase our merit in all worlds to come." As the robbers were eating, they heard the sound of drums, brum, brum, from behind the village, where old Sautika had stationed a few servants. The chief asked, "What is that?" And the little lady answered, as she had been instructed to do, "Oh, that's only the sepoys, I'm not sure if that's the right pronunciation, whom the king left to protect the village during the absence of the able-bodied." Then, with many kind words, she returned with her maidens and the empty carts to the village. As soon as she was gone, the chief said to his followers, "It would be cruel to attack the village after all this kindness. Neither are we able to fight against the king's police," for he thought that they were already there. So he says, "Let us go and let's seek what we need elsewhere." I like that story. And, you know, it reminds me of Koho Zenji, Reverend Master Jiyu's master. One of the things that helped me so many times that he taught her was about, you know, what's helpful, the truth, the whole truth, and anything else that works. And, you know, here's a young person with, a wonderful idea that actually worked. There are many such stories. I know of some well-known ones up in British Columbia, too, where the daughters of Indian chiefs prevented bloodshed among various tribes by suggesting that the chief, next time the tribe comes down from the north, instead of fighting them, how about inviting them to a potlatch, you know, which was a big gift-giving and potluck kind of thing. And it worked. Anyway, things like that. You know, these are simple stories, but they do point to something that we can practice in our daily lives, even in little ways, even if we're not, we don't have people breaking our door down to take our belongings. And if we do, well, maybe it will give us some insight into how to respond. So I would like to just add a little statement in here about the practice of kindness and the difference between that and what we sometimes refer to as the love and light heresy. Heresy in Buddhism meaning a confusion about religion. And this is a good example. Kindness has to be practiced with wisdom as well. It doesn't mean you become completely foolish. And we can sometimes lean in that direction. If I'm just nice to everybody, they're going to be nice to me and everything's going to be fine. And there is a great deal of truth in that. But we also, there are other virtues that we need to cultivate, and we have to have our eyes open in practicing kindness. It goes deeper than just sweet words, but the sweet words have to be there as well. And I say that just in case that can be misunderstood sometimes. Sometimes a teacher has to give some direct teaching that is a little painful to the student, and that can be a great act of kindness as well. So we have to cultivate, as the Buddha did and as these people did in the story, skillful means with our acts of kindness and generosity. So I'm going to end with Reverend Master Jiu's teaching on harmony in the Sangha. We're talking about it on personal level, on the level of the world, and I find this to be one of the most helpful teachings on a deeper level, again, to what promotes harmony. And this is really runs through all of the Noble Eightfold Path. Harmony is the Sangha treasure. This is brought about by the knowledge that no matter what a member of the Sangha may do, he or she is immaculate from the very beginning, i.e., each of us has that purity of Buddha nature. There is nothing from the first. There's no, as I was taught when I was little, there's no big black blotches on your soul when you do something bad that you can never get rid of. Those may appear at times, but they are dissolvable. There's always a remedy. And they don't touch that fundamental purity, that fundamental light. So this is an important thing to keep in mind when we're wanting to find how to, you know, promote harmony among peoples, and in the Sangha in particular. Thus shall you think of all this fleeting world, a star at dawn, a bubble in a stream, a child's laugh, a phantasm, a dream. A quote from the Diamond Sutra about the unreality of all these things that we get attached to, all these things that we worry about and get upset about. Although this is true, the members of the Sangha, even the Zen masters, all beings are bound by the law of karma. They will pay the price of what they do. In other words, karma is working very well. The law of karma works quite well all by itself, and it's based in deep compassion. And we don't have to add to it. We don't have a moral imperative to add to the law of karma. It doesn't help. But to understand it and to become one with it is another matter. And thus is the mind of the Sangha treasure, she says.